Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun, too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Couric, and this is Next Question. We're doing something a little bit different this week, something that I'm going to try throughout this season of the podcast, and that is to do a Katie Plus One episode. I am so lucky. I know so many great people. They're interesting. They're fun to talk to. They're special to me. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to invite people to join me and be my little partner in crime on this podcast. So we're doing it today with my friend Kelly Rizzo. And hi, Kelly.
Hi, Katie. I'm so honored to be A, your plus one, and B, your partner in crime. And for the first time, me being your partner in crime doesn't involve cocktails or cooking.
That's true. That's true. Just talking. And I thought maybe we could tell everyone listening, Kelly, how we know each other. And we actually haven't been friends for all that long. I mean, you're a new friend, which I think is so important. And that's something I love to do. You know that Girl Scout song? Make new friends, but keep the old. One is silver and the other's gold. Now, it's a round, actually, but we're not going to subject our listeners to that.
It has been a little over a year and a half that we've been friends. We met right after my husband, Bob, passed away because you had reached out through a mutual friend because you had gone through that same loss about 20-something years earlier.
Four years earlier. Yes, exactly.
You were about the same age that I was when this happened, so you know what it feels like to have gone through a loss at that time. And you reached out just kind of offering a friendly ear and a friendly hand, and you're like, I'm here if you want to talk. And of course, I took her up on that.
I just remember thinking when I was reading about what happened to Bob, who I always really liked. Actually, I had a date with him once, as you know.
I know.
I really liked him. I found him so cute and funny and amusing. And I did think we shared a pretty nice kiss in the foyer of my apartment, but
he always thought you were lovely.
What can I say?
He was a big fan. He adored you.
Well, not enough to call me again, but that's okay. That's okay because it all worked out. It all worked out. He found the love of his life with you.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, gosh, Kelly, I remember those strange, surreal days following Jay's death. I thought, I know a little bit what Kelly's feeling right now. I'm just going to say, hey, if you need me, I'm here. We had dinner and then we've just stayed in touch because I've also been very excited about your career and what's ahead for you and tried to give you some advice in that department. So I'm just thrilled.
There's no better mentor to have than you.
Well,
and I've been so grateful, A, for your friendship, B, for your guidance on the personal level, but then C, for your guidance and mentorship on the career side of things. And I'm just, I mean, when Katie Couric calls you and says, hey, do you want to do an interview with me? You say yes. And especially when it's such a dear friend of mine as well, which I'm very excited about.
That's one of the reasons I thought this would be a very good chemistry. And it was serendipitous that my guest today is someone who you know well. I always hate when people say that instead of who for a person. Mm-hmm. People make that mistake a lot, by the way. Is John Stamos.
Katie, if you and I went out instead of you and Bob, we'd probably still be dating.
Quit it some more, John.
What was Bob thinking?
Out of me, Coulier, Saget, you could have started with me.
Well, you didn't ask, John. And I don't think you were available at the time.
Did Bob ask you out?
Yeah, they went out on a date. He asked her out.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, I remember. And we talked about it. I think he was intimidated by you.
Oh, please.
He was not really good. I used to have to Sierra know him. Like, I would tell him what to text and what to say, what to do on these dates. And maybe I should have gone back to my text and see, because I feel like I was texting him. I said, don't blow X martyr on Katie. She's a very intelligent woman. She's not just beautiful. She's, be careful, Bob. And, you know, and you guys kissed,
we
right?
We did. And as Kelly knows, he was a good kisser.
Oh, I know too.
To be honest,
three of us,
John,
here that have kissed him, and you know,
you guys had some cuddles that you've cuddled on camera and off, probably. Yeah. And you guys joke. You even joke in your book that you've shared a bed with him on multiple occasions.
We were like an old married couple. We didn't have sex, and we argued all the time.
That's funny, John.
That is.
Well, you know, I learned from Bob. Thank you for having me on this. And what a great idea. But isn't it called Katie Plus One? Like, don't you always have
the name of the podcast is Next Question. And some conversations, honestly, John, lend themselves to sort of a single person doing an interview. And some are much better for when there's a connection or someone is passionate about a topic. So this is really an experiment. And Kelly is my first person to do this with. And anyway, when I was going to be in L.A. visiting my daughter, and I know you both live in L.A., I thought, wow, this will be a great opportunity, because I'm excited to talk to you about your book and your life. And I know what a big deal this is, John, because I wrote a memoir that came out, now about 2 years ago. I can't believe it. And it was a very stressful time, because you do open up your heart and kind of spill your guts on the page. And it's scary, right?
It was the last thing on my mind. I never thought about writing a book. It wasn't a goal of mine. I didn't think I could do it. Certainly in my juvenile thinking, I thought, well, all people would care about is, you know, talking about who I slept with. And I'm not going to say that, because, you know, not that many anyway. But, it, you know, so I'm never going to write a book. And I'd never found I just didn't think it was something that I would ever do. And then, you know, I became a father, and that kind of, you know, was maybe, you know, people were asking, but I don't know. Then Bob died. And I sat down to write that obituary type thing in the LA Times. And I just kind of poured out of me. And I think the agents saw that and they said, oh, hey, you should write a book. I'm like, no, yes, there's very good writing in that. And I still said no for a long time. And I just couldn't figure out. I didn't want to. I didn't think I could. And I didn't know how. I didn't know where to start. And then I remembered my mom's letters that she wrote me. And she wrote these beautiful notes that that we've kept over the years. And I kind of put them together. I said, okay, this is a good starting point. And but then I wanted to write a love letter to all the people that have been so beautiful in my life. Certainly Bob. I mean, Bob is a through line through the whole. You know, I decided to write I don't know where you started in your book, but I started with the two hardest things that I could write about. One was this horrific day. I was going to meet Bob at the Palm, and I got a DUI, and, you know, it was the lowest point of my life. And my five stages of grief then were, you know, sex and more booze, and it was terrible. And then the second chapter that I wrote was the final one, the day I found out that Bob died. And I sort of go through it pretty meticulously, right, Kelly? And then my five stages of grief there were therapy and family and health. And then I just had to fill in the rest of it. But Bob was certainly, it was interesting. I was just thinking, I don't know if I would have wrote this. Because a lot of times when I was writing about Bob, I was like, ooh, what would he, if he was alive, would he? I don't think I would have written this book if he was still around.
Wow. I mean, clearly, I think a life event like that has such a profound impact and reminds you of your mortality. And,
right.
You know,
you lost your husband. How long? When was that?
It was in 1998, believe it or not. So it has been, 25 years now, right?
And what does that feel like? Is it like the more time that goes by, the less you feel it? And that feels shitty too, right?
It does, actually. Yeah. But I mean, Kelly and I had a long conversation about that for her podcast. And, you know, I always think if something were to happen to me, I wouldn't want the people I left behind. I'd want them to be sad for a little while. I'd want them to be very, very, very sad. But I wouldn't want that sadness to overcome them and be a through line through the rest of their lives. As much as, you know, I'd want them to think about me. But you want people to be as joyful and feel good. You don't want people to feel terrible. And Kelly's very much that attitude.
I know Kelly struggled. Didn't you struggle with that, Kelly?
Yeah.
You started to feel sort of good and have a nice half a day, and then you felt guilty.
Right, well,
that Bob would be mad. He would be mad, but at this point.
Well, that's what I'm saying, John. Like, you know better than anybody. I've had to differentiate between earthly Bob and heavenly Bob. Mm-hmm. Heavenly Bob, of course, would want me to be happy and would want me to enjoy life and to
maybe
move forward.
Maybe meet someone.
Right. But earthly Bob, absolutely not. Earthly Bob would be like, how dare you? How could you? You're smiling. Oh, so you didn't love me at all, right? I knew it. You know, like that's how earthly Bob would be. And so you have to separate them, you know, and you know that better than anybody, John, like how he would have been if he could talk about his own death. But he never wanted to talk about it because he said he was going to live forever.
Right. You called me yesterday crying, and it was I started crying. But what you said was that the people that didn't know Bob, when they read your book, they'll know the real Bob. And that meant so much to me because I've just been struggling with not having him around. And as I know you are, but writing the book was, it was my way of being close to him again. And hopefully, and I feel that phone call made me, because I just wanted him to be proud of the way I wrote about him. And you know, you said he would be. So that was all I needed to hear.
Not only would he be proud, I mean, I was just so touched and blown away by how you portrayed and depicted your relationship with him. You said things about me in there that like I didn't even know or that I had forgotten. And there were so many parts of this book that, I mean, even myself as your friend, somebody who knows you very well, like I didn't know. And it's such...
Like what?
Oh my gosh, just... Even stories about Bob, because keep in mind, I had only heard Bob's perspective on a lot of things. And, you know, and we'll get to this, but, you know, your relationship with him, even when you guys first started doing Full House together, I knew that you guys weren't besties from day one, but, you know, I only heard Bob's side of the story. So it was very interesting to get your side of the story.
Yeah, it was, the two hardest, I thought that the writing the chapter about Bob or the opening chapter was going to be the hardest. The hardest chapter, two chapters really that I wrote were the Full House ones, because I didn't, I know how important the show was to people, and people ask, Jeff Franklin was over here the other day and he's writing a book and he was asking me, like, when did I come to terms with the fact that, you know, Full House, and when did I like it? When did I accept it? And the truth is not until really, honestly to myself, until I wrote this book, until I put down on paper what that show meant to people, how much it influenced life and how it was everybody's family. It wasn't just, you know, the latchkey kid coming home. It was her family and the widower who turns it up a little louder. It was his family. And, you know, it's become, you know, the new normal, unconventional family. And the central character on that show was love. And it was representing the best of who we could be. And the critics used to just drive me nuts. And I finally just let all that go writing this book and said, this show wasn't meant for you guys. You're not smarter than me. I get it. It was facile at times. It was silly. It was big. But what you missed is right under that. When you put, it gave you a chance to, the brain goes to the side and lets the heart feel. And that's what you intellectual dummies didn't get, that I got, and the rest of the world got too. So we weren't making it for you, but just digging at it, writing it down, and then talking about the relationship with Bob. I mean, it did start off rough. I came from, you know, a sitcom with Jack Klugman, who was, you know, one of the great television actors, and Gary Marshall was on that show, and all these brilliant comics. And every scene that we approached was from story and character and why I would say this. And that's the way I went into Full House. Well, it was, Bob certainly didn't work that way. Bob, as Kelly could attest, was a laugh junkie. He was addicted to getting laughs. And if he couldn't get them from where he's, you know, in the show, it was like going down to Skid Row and getting them. He would make the crew, he would just go for the lowest, you know, not the crew, but the type of comedy to make them laugh. And it was intrusive to my process. So, and then just trying to figure out, like, when did we click? And it really wasn't until his sister got scleroderma and Dave's sister had a terrible cancer. Then they found a brain tumor in my sister. So the three of us were not just sitcom guys that working together. We were three brothers that were losing their sisters. And that's when we really, I think, connected.
That must have been incredibly, gosh, I mean, obviously, I know Bob's story well about his sister, and I've gone to events for the Scleroderma Foundation, but for Dave to have his sister sick, and you, John, I know she was later diagnosed with MS, and it didn't turn out to be a brain tumor after all, but to have those life and death situations, that must have been an incredibly bonding experience for the three of you, and it was that the moment everything changed?
I think so. It sort of just said, what are we doing? Let's put aside our petty bullshit. Let's learn from each other. I'll come a little closer to your process. You come to mine. And we did that. And you know what else was interesting, just thinking it through, is that my sister made it, like you said, and theirs didn't. So that was I felt guilt about that too. It was strange. But we just continued to build our love for each other. And, you know, thinking about that last dinner, Kelly, I mean, Bob was, it was just, you know, it was everything you wanted in Bob that night. He was just at his, to me, and it was at his best. And little things that normally bothered me about him didn't, because I too was coming, you know, was starting to come around and be like, you know, not to be such an asshole. And, you know, it was, and then he wrote this beautiful thing in Instagram. And you don't think of the last time you take a picture like that to be their last time with somebody.
Set the scene for me, John and Kelly, you guys. We're on a double date. You were at Nobu in Malibu, right? And Kelly, do you remember that night being as magical as John does?
I do. But I'm going to backtrack even one more second, because John, this is something that now literally this just popped in my head. You had said how he was at his best and you were at your best. But I'm thinking back to even maybe just like a month before that is when you guys remember you had that work trip, I think, to Florida, mm-hmm. and you guys were bickering like the old married couple the whole time. And I remember Bob came home, yeah. and he's like, oh, we were driving each other nuts, and John was mean to me, and then I'm sure I was mean to him. And, you know, you guys were bickering. And then we had this dinner that was the complete and total like resolution from that. And so there was none of that. You guys, you know, I mean, I've been at many dinners with you guys where even you'll bicker like the old married couple, and you guys were just having the best time. And we truly did have this wonderful, wonderful dinner that I'm so grateful that you put it into words and you documented that better than even my memory allowed. So I'm grateful that I had you as my like documentarian. So thank you for that and for kind of restating it so beautifully.
Yeah, it was special. He was special. You know, look, I mean, it's, you don't think of losing someone like this so fast and so, but we've bummed everybody out.
Yeah, well, you know what? I think it's beautiful. We'll be back with more of John Stamos and my date for this podcast, Kelly Rizzo, right after this. If you want to get smarter every morning with a breakdown of the news and fascinating takes on health and wellness and pop culture, sign up for our daily newsletter, Wake Up Call, by going to katiecouric.com. This podcast is brought to you by NerdWallet. Are you paying for your me time with just any credit card in your wallet? While you shouldn't stop treating yourself, you should start paying with a credit card that has perks. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending. So what could future you do with better rewards? A free flight? Room upgrades? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We're back with John Stamos, Kelly Rizzo, and moi. There is a lot more to you, John Stamos, than Bob Saget. and the book is really, while Bob plays an important role and is a through line, as you said, it's really a love letter also to your family, to growing up. So I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, you grew up in Orange County in an extremely close-knit family with your parents and your two sisters, one older, one younger.
Can I say real fast, you are so great. I haven't seen you do this in a long time, you know, because you're not on the morning shows. It's just hearing your voice, like you were saying, Kelly, like she's so iconic. She's so, you're so effing smart, but you're also cute and you have this this likability about you and this smile and just to be, because I don't think we've done many interviews together to be interviewed by you like this. Sorry to interrupt you, but I just,
Oh no, please, go on.
How lucky am I to sit, go on, next to her? I'm just so, I feel so
okay,
honored.
And you look great.
Okay,
I mean, you really don't,
you
don't age either.
Thank you.
I say either because I'm talking to myself as well.
You look damn good. Can I just say, John Stamos, you look damn good.
Big 6-0.
Can I just say, look at that head of hair. What is that?
Well, I have this very large poster, but big. Like, I asked my assistant to get a little thing for the book, and it's like the whole wall.
I think it's fitting. I think it's appropriate.
I'm sending it to you, Katie.
Anyway.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
Getting back to
you,
my question, thank you for those nice things that you just said. But I want you to just describe your childhood, because, you know, it's so fun to hear how people grew up and how their childhoods made them the people they became. I'm fascinated by that. More conversations are going on about, you know, how you're raised and trauma and all that stuff. And it sounds like you had a pretty lovely childhood. Your dad owned a restaurant called the Yellow Basket, and you worked there as a teen, and you worshipped your dad. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, he was my hero. He was, you know, he was larger than life. And I think when some kids, they reach the age where they go, eh, he's just a human. My dad was always a superhero to me. He was, till the day he died, he was the coolest motherfucker. I mean, he, you know, I got one of the perks of doing what we do is we get to, you know, do great things, is meet people. And my dad loved Sinatra. And so I got to take him to a Sinatra concert. I didn't know Rickles at the time, but he was opening up and there was Frank. And this is how cool my dad was. So we got a chance to go back and meet him. It was hard to do. And they said, Mr. Sinatra wants to see you. You'll know. I'm like, yeah, smoke signal. Okay. And somebody, a little Tony O came during intermission. Mr. Sinatra, we'll see you now. So we go back and we're taking pictures and everything. And it was time to take everybody to take a picture. And I was like, come on, dad, let's get a picture. Here's Sinatra. Actually, you love him. And he said, no, I'm good. And just sat back and just, it was enough for him to see his son with Sinatra. And my mom, on the other hand, you know, Jilly Rizzo nearly, you know, killed her. She jumped on him and she was trying to kiss him. But my dad was so fucking cool, man. He just stayed back. I was like, no, it's okay. He was a great man. And I got so much from him. But one of the things that I highlighted in the book was that the way he treated people, he treated his busboy the same way he would treat his best customer. And I think, and I worked on Sundays and I got General Hospital during that time. And I remember getting, when I got the role, I was in the casting office and I said, I got to call home. And I called home and the phone answers and everybody was around the phone and said, I got bad news. I got it. And they were screaming. And in the back, you can hear my dad go, make sure you don't work on Sundays. I need you on Sundays. And sure enough, I auditioned. I got it 2 days later. I shot it the day after that and it aired 2 weeks later. And it was 35 million people a day, you know, seeing the show General Hospital. And I would still have to go to work on Sunday to be my dad's Sunday guy, you know, and people started coming in and recognizing me. I said, Dad, I'm famous. Can I quit? But I think it took, and he came down and saw me on the set one day, and he saw the way that I handled people like he does, I think. And then he said, all right, enough of the restaurant. This is a real thing for you. Go. I love you, son. Be the best you can be and go.
And he wasn't that old when he passed away.
No. Yeah, he was 65. It was terrible. And he wasn't, he was emotional enough. You know how, you know, strong Greek dad he was, you know. My mom would say, I love you every other word. And he said, God damn it, Loretta, you're wearing it out. Just say it that way. He came to Yugoslavia when I was doing a movie in the 90s. And he came home and he wrote this beautiful letter and faxed it to me. And I read it then, whatever. So when he had a stroke in the airport in Las Vegas and was in a stroke, he was in a coma for 6 months and he was at our house and I knew he was going to die any day. And I was looking around in his closet and his drawers for something I could keep. He was a super humble guy, drove the same car forever. I found a crappy old watch that didn't work, but I moved a shirt or something and I saw, I love you, Dad. I was like, oh, my heart stopped. Like, what is this? And it was the original letter that he had faxed me in Yugoslavia. And I have it up there. And the way he laid it out was, you know, A, you know, being on the set, the way you handle people really made me proud. And B, my chest is 60 inches, you know, wow, because of you. And C, he says, a man doesn't have many great moments, but you have given me many. I love you, Dad.
Aw. And now you have that framed in your office at home.
Yeah. I write a lot of notes to my kid. I don't know if you
do. Well, no, but now I'm feeling like I should have written. My mom used to put little notes in my lunch bag and say things like, don't get stuck in your peanut butter sandwich. But or when she put a banana, that's no banana lady. That's my nose, Jimmy Durante. Those I think were the only two notes she wrote me. But it's a very sweet thing. And
I mean, I love how. I mean, obviously, I've heard wonderful stories about your mom, but the way she's depicted in your book, of course, is, I mean, she's an angel, she's a saint. And I love that these notes that she's written you, that you actually have in the book, they're like these little guideposts and signposts throughout each chapter. So how did you come up with that idea?
Well, I was looking for a hook, I guess, to this book. Like, you know, and I remember telling the agents, like, I don't like that book, like The Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Like, I need something like that, you know. And if you would have told me thing, a friend of mine said, hey, why don't you call it if you would have told me? Because I've said that forever. A friend of mine, Neil, was over and Mike Love was calling me and I didn't answer it. And I said, if you would have told me when I was a kid, my first show concert I ever went to was the Beach Boys, that I wouldn't answer the phone when Mike Love called. So it was like, so then I started that. And then the notes, I knew I had them and I knew my sisters had some. So I gathered all those together and sort of laid them out. And I was like, oh, this is kind of going along with my, you know, in the first chapter. You know, when I was getting ready to get in my car and go see Bob at the Palm and, you know, and I never made it. I looked at the wall, all the frame walls, and I have one of her notes framed and said, don't give the devil a ride. He'll end up doing the driving. And I was like, oh, wow.
Wow.
Okay. So that goes there.
Wow.
You know.
So she just did it all the time? Or when would she give you these notes? Would she put them under your pillow? How did it work?
Sometimes they'd be on the pillow. Towards the end, when my dad died and I was got divorced and, you know, we were both in a rough place and we needed each other. It was close to being, you know, too much, but it was definitely a needy relationship. I would go there and she called her house the Castle of Comfort. And so there'd be notes saying, welcome to the Castle of Comfort. But a lot of them, you know, I found in like birthday cards. It's like some of the stuff she said in these birthday cards were like, wow, you know, like, thank God gave you to me and dad. Me and your dad and blah, blah, blah. You know, and I found one too. I don't know if it's in there. I think so. Yeah. It was like, I was the only person that shared a heartbeat with her. Like, where did she get that from? But I never thought about that, but you know, that's true.
That's beautiful.
It is.
I write sometimes, Caitlin and I both wrote Billy a letter when he was born. We put it in the safe. But what I do is I set up an email account for him. So I'll email him once a week, once a month or whatever. And it's easier just to kind of talk into the phone and email. And then someday, I guess I'll write him out. But he's probably got already a couple hundred, you know, letters from me waiting for him.
That's so cool. You know, I had wanted to do that. You know, the best laid plans of mice and men. I had wanted to write my daughters a letter every year to say, this is what happened this year. You know, this is what you did. These were some of the moments we had. And John, do you think I did it? Of course not.
Well, how old are they? That's a great idea.
They're 32 and 28 now. So I would like to write them one letter. Just, you know, my book, but my book was kind of my letter to my girls.
Right.
You know, that's right. And I kind of put it all out, and my life lessons are, and that's actually one of the reasons I wanted to write my book. I wanted to record something, not necessarily for strangers, but for my daughters, you know, that would memorialize my life. And I think this is something great for your son, you know?
Yeah, I think so. You know, he's a little shit today. he slept with us. He slept with me. Caitlin was gone for a couple of nights, so he crawled into bed with me. And it was yesterday, and I wake up, and he's like, you know, his little face is right up next to my nose right now. And he said, "Dad," I go, "Yeah." He goes, "You smell like the bathroom at my school." Well, thank you, son.
Thanks, Billy.
Thank you, Billy. Well, he's so funny, and his humor is a lot closer to Bob's than mine. And that's, you know, sometimes I really get bummed out that Bob doesn't, because he said, "Dad, if you have to pee and you hold it longer, the pee nest goes away," or something like that. So that's something Uncle Bob would have talked about.
That is close to a Bob joke that we know about.
Yeah,
right. He likes potty humor.
I walked by, and a couple weeks after Bob passed away, and he was the nanny was showing him Full House, and most of the time he watches it just to get enough ammo to make fun of me, you know, to goof on me, and a little sort like, "Billy, go clean up your toys." "You got it, dude." You know, but
no way.
This particular show
was now?
He's 5 and a half. I think it was the Beach Boys, and it was this scene where Danny was telling Uncle Jesse he wishes he had his life, the rock and roll are cool, and Jesse was saying, "I wish I had your life, the family and stuff." And in truth, it was the real us. It wasn't the characters. And I just lost it. And I was kind of, he could see me out of the side of Perfield. And you know, in a moment of coolness that I haven't seen since, he let me have that moment. And I was, you know, I was just choked up. And he looked at me, and I just kind of walked away. But so sometimes he can be cool. He's the light of my life.
He's so cute. You know. He's so cute. He's like a little mini John.
He's a handsome kid.
I stalk you guys on Instagram. It's so weird, right?
I try to teach him, because now it's like a lot of people go, "Oh, you're cute. You're charming." And I said, "No, you're not. You know, I got
to
figure out how to..."
Yeah, you don't want it to get to his head, right?
Well, also, you have to praise different things. You have to praise his grit, the fact that
he doesn't give up,
that he tries, the fact that he's kind to other people.
Yes.
Yeah, that's so important, because especially for girls, like I used to say, if somebody said to my girls, "Oh, you're pretty," and I'd say, "But they're very smart, actually. They're smarter than they are."
Yeah. I tell them that. Just this morning, I said, you want people to like you because you're smart and you're kind and you're compassionate," which he is.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, but he's a little, and I wasn't like this as a kid. I guess Caitlin was a flirt or whatever. He's got girls around. Remember Kelly at my birthday party a couple of weeks ago? Like Bella and Stella and Isabella.
Isabella.
It's too much. We were in Disney in Paris, and I swear this out. So it was 2 days, and the first day we had a guide, an older French woman, very nice, but maybe in her 50s or 60s, and you know, Billy was like, "Yeah, whatever." The next day, this beautiful 30-year-old French woman shows up. "Hello," and Billy's like, "Boom." And here's his move, which I can't use because I'm married, but he's like, "So, what's my favorite color?"
Stop.
"So, what kind of, what's my favorite animal?" Like he's quizzing them on his stuff. So, and then I kind of overhear him talking about his girlfriend, Bella. He's got "my girlfriend, Bella, and she lives in the neighborhood, and she's really nice and smart." Then the lady goes, "Oh, excuse me, I have to go to the bathroom," and she walks away. Swear to God, as soon as she's out of earshot, he goes to me and goes, "Why did I tell her I had a girlfriend?"
Wow.
Like he had a shot.
He's already a player. Yeah.
That is so funny.
I don't like it.
Wait, so speaking of Disney, so obviously I know you as the biggest Disney freak of anyone I've ever met in my life. Like, I didn't know, like, Disney file was a thing until I met you. But in your book, you talk about, like, the origins of it, which was so interesting to me because I never really knew where it came from.
Growing up next to Disney, yeah. Well, I mean, you're talking about childhood. My childhood it couldn't have gone better. And I think a lot of kids would go to Disneyland to escape whatever they were dealing with at home. And I it was the opposite for me. I just loved it. But it was also, once you walk through those gates, the artistry and, you know, the way that, that these brilliant imagineers want you to feel, H. Lambs, I really got attracted to that. And it was a place, that's sort of where I reached puberty there. It was a place to, you know, try to pick up girls. I never really quite got it.
It was kind of your mall growing up, maybe.
Yeah, right, yes. And so, I'd be standing in line there with my dad's members only jacket and zits and hair feathered.
Members and, like, only, God, that brings back memories.
Right?
My dad still wears his members only jacket.
The chicks didn't like that, I realized. But Kelly, we all went, we had a great, remember we all, the
yeah, for
six
Caitlin's
of
birthday.
Us, Dave and his wife, Melissa, and we all wore onesies, remember?
Yeah, Bob was not happy because it didn't quite fit
him.
Didn't
like his onesie.
He couldn't quite zip it, and he was very unhappy that we forced him to wear the onesie.
But you proposed to your wife at Disney World or Land, I guess, Disneyland out here, Disney World in Orlando.
Yeah, like I had a choice. I was done with Disney until I met her, and then she fucked me back in again.
One of the things you write about, John, is that you wanted to be famous from the beginning. I mean, why? What did you see that sparked that in you that said, I want to be a household name, or I want people to know me?
Yeah, I do say that a lot, and it is true, but in closer look, that it was really about being liked, because before the bullying was even a term, some jackass gave me a black eye because his girlfriend wanted to go out with me, and, you know, that was so humiliating, and I wasn't, you know, I was a dorky kid. I like puppets and magic, and there's nothing cool about any of it. And girls, I put a picture in the book of me with a puppet trying to impress some girl, and she's like, And then, you know, the next picture you see me on drums, like, I gotta. But so I think it was more of just wanting to be liked. But I did, you know, being famous was something that I wanted first, and then I learned, acting, okay, I'll learn that. But did you find this writing your book that I really discovered my story as I was writing it? Like, again, like, I didn't think it's your life. So you go, it's okay. It's, I do that. I play with a beach. But as you, when you write it all down, it's a lot.
Yeah.
And I was always sort of trying to find the relatable, you know, places. And certainly being a dorky kid and being bullied, you know, was one, and being cheated on, you know, I think, you know, people probably think, he's never going to get cheated on. Look at him, you know, my wife cheated on me because I have no money. I'm not good. Like, no. It's people are assholes. That's why you got cheated on. So I was trying to find as many relatable moments throughout the book, and they kind of came. But what I was going to ask you was, did you find, like, as I was discovering my story, I realized so many things that happened back then that I get now. It was in the middle of a lot of cultural, being on General Hospital, and the storylines between the black actors and the white actors was so different, and they had to get their hair done in another place. And look back and say, wait a minute, that's segregation. You know, now, we're dealing with homophobia in the theater, inequality in the workplace for women. My dad, it was so great to write about my dad. My mom wanted to be a housewife, and she was great. And my dad never held that over. He never said, I'm the one who make the money, you don't. In fact, he thought her and praised her for her job was harder and more important. And it was. Those are the examples that I had. But looking back at all those, you know, those kind of tent poles moments of my life, interesting.
It is interesting. I think also, if you look back, how much things have changed.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I'm older than you are, John, I think by 6 years, but.
You are? Well, how old are you?
I'm 66.
Yeah.
So kind of the same generation. And, you know, you think about, like, when we were little, nobody was out if they were gay. I mean, it was a very closeted world. So much homophobia. You think about, you know, if there wasn't segregation, obviously, there was de facto segregation with the black part of town where I grew up. And women, obviously, the role of women and the aspirations you could have as a young woman. My mom was a housewife as well. And my dad never, you know, lauded that over her, but she just didn't have that many choices. You know, there weren't that many opportunities for my mom to have a life outside the home in a very tangible way. So sometimes when I was writing my book, I would be like, wow, we have really evolved as a culture. Obviously, we have a long way to go. It's not like we've eradicated sexism or racism or all the isms that haunt us as a society. But the progress that has been made, it is the changes in attitudes. It's pretty, it's something to behold.
Yeah. And I think, you know, yeah, exactly. And I'm thinking about you know, some of the sexual endeavors that I went through in my life that, you know, you think of them as, back then it was like, oh, every schoolboy's dream. You know, I walked into my dressing room, there's a naked girl in the closet, and this penthouse pet came in and had sex with me. And I'm happy to say that they were not what I thought it was going to be. I didn't feel good after. I didn't like it. I wanted love. I wanted like my family. But yeah, so I found those things. We certainly, this Me Too movement has been so incredible because women have really done a brilliant job at making us men, you know, straighten up and look at the way that they've been treated over the years. So a lot of that. But then you look at some, then we, you know, with racism and some of this stuff, like, have we not got past this yet? Come on. There was so much of it, I guess, tamped down. We thought, okay, we're moving forward. And now it's bubbling up again. And so,
but I think we're having the kind of conversations about it, John, that we never did when we were younger. Mm-hmm. I think it was just sort of part of our lives. And I remember when I did my daytime talk show, which I renamed my stupid daytime talk show, even though there were some good episodes. But I remember thinking, that's a longer story. Read my book. But it's just that I never got to the kind of things that I really wanted to explore was not necessarily perfect for what a daytime audience was looking for.
And nowadays you would say, fuck you, this is the way I want to do my show, and here's what I'm talking about.
Well, I did, and it was canceled. But anyway.
Well, okay, good though.
But I remember wanting to do a story, an episode or a show on race. And I remember, like, we couldn't figure out how to address it or how to attack it because it just wasn't part of the national conversation back then. So in a way, we've had so many growing pains talking about systemic racism and even sexism, but at least they're being talked about, if not solved, right?
Yeah, then there's some culpability. There's some people that are having to... you know, it's interesting. The publisher kept saying, where's Lori? We want to talk about the college scandal. You got to write about that. I said, no, I don't. And I talked to Lori about it. She said, yeah, go ahead. Say anything you want. You can defend me. I said, you sure? Yeah. And I sort of wrote it out. I said, no, this is not, I didn't like it. And then, so it was nothing there. And then I said, it does feel like there's something missing. And I went back and I just wrote about, from my point of view, the way she went through it. Everybody makes mistakes, big and small. And by the way, like the last person you'd think on Full House that would go to jail. The first would be me, probably Jody, or both of us together. But the way she, you know, it was a study in resilience and the way she got up every day and, you know, took care of her family and took care of her marriage. I mean, I would have crumbled way before she did. So that was interesting to be able to just write about her and have that conversation, not picking sides.
She is so strong. Just her attitude and outlook on everything, you know, for what she went through to just have such a positive, just a smile on her face and a positive outlook on things. It's really remarkable.
But that must have been mortifying and horrifying for her to go through. And people, I mean, I'm not saying what she did was right, but people are so cruel and so righteous and judgmental. That must have been really hard.
The mud that was slung at her kids daily too, you know, and her family. But she, you know, yeah, I mean, it was the way that she handled it. And she was accountable. She did everything she was supposed to do, go to jail, do this, you know, and a lot of people don't know that during that time she was going and helping kids in schools and, you know, underprivileged kids and bringing food to, anyway, she's a saint and she made a big mistake. In typical Lori fashion, when she got out of jail, she said, how was it? She goes, oh, it wasn't bad. I met a couple of really nice ladies. We're in our book club now. And it was like, okay,
yeah.
Lori.
She said she took the time to get to know everyone there and learn their stories. And they all had a lot of difficult stories. And she really wanted to understand, like, what brings people to that place, you know?
She's never really done an interview, has she?
No. No. You should get her on.
Well, maybe she would talk to me about it. Anyway.
Yeah.
John, I wanted to ask you just a few more things about the book. And one is your obsession or lifelong love, I should say, of music. And you included a Nietzsche quote in your yearbook, without music, life would be a mistake.
Yeah. My dad thought it was so stupid. He goes, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. Really, Dad? Well, look who I'm playing with today.
Well, let's talk about your music and how you fell in love with music and the whole process of that.
I was drumming was my main thing. And by the way, if you can, let's see, can you see? Kelly was kind enough to give me Bob's guitar. That's the black one in the middle. See that? And I don't play it because if I picked it up and started playing, it'd be like, my dog licked my balls, fuck, yeah. You know. So I try not to pick it up.
You can only play dirty songs on there.
But not to digress, and I'll go back. Kelly, there's one recording of this song before Bob died, and he was working it into his act, and it's about, I saw it the other day. He sings a song about falling in love with her dad.
It's about my dad. It's called I'm Not in Love with My Wife's Father.
Yeah.
And it's about my dad, and it's hilarious. And there's only one, because he never recorded it, and it was going to be in his new special. And so he didn't want anyone else to record it because he didn't want it getting out there because it's supposed to be a surprise in the special. And so I recorded it at one of his last shows ever in Denver. And I have a video of it. And at some point I need to release it. And John had, you know, a good idea for maybe how we should release that one day. But
maybe you could do it and raise money for scleroderma or something.
What was the idea, to play it right now on Katie's podcast?
No. I wish it. I was thinking, of course, you know, I like the way you think, John Stamos. But then I was thinking, oh, no, Kelly's way too smart for that.
Well, it's got to be debuted somewhere.
I don't know. Well, no, she had a good idea. It could be to raise money for the SRF.
Okay. By the way, this is the bracelet that we put out to raise money for Bob's charity and Kelly's charity. And it's the biggest selling bracelet. We have a thing called St. Amos, and you can buy a bracelet. This is one for Bob.
I know. I love that you guys did that. Thank you.
And wait,
so much.
What does it go for? Is that for scleroderma? Something else?
Yeah.
Well, it's their charity, like in conjunction with the SRF, which is really, really nice.
And what is your charity, John?
So thoughtful.
Well, I've devoted the last 30, 35 years to abuse children and to, you know, to stop that, which it's, you know, it's been on the rise since the pandemic. And, I talk a little bit about it in the book, something that happened to me. I felt sort of like a charlatan not talking about, I had a incident with a babysitter when I was about 12 or so, and it was, I stuffed it away. I came back when I was writing a speech an event that they were giving me an award for the childhood. And I said, you know what? Now is not the time. I'm going to pack this away. And then when I was writing the book, I was just like, did I put everything in here that I will? Oh, wait a minute. What about that? And I talked to my sisters and I talked to Caitlin, and it's very brief, but it was important to me to talk about it. It's a very, you know, uncomfortable situation with a babysitter. And, I think the rate is like 7 out of every 25, girls have been, you know, sexually abused, and only 4 or something out of every 25 men, boys. But that's because boys don't talk about it. So I felt it was sort of important to tell my incident there.
The numbers are really amazing, aren't they? When you think about it, how prevalent it is and, what a hidden dark secret is for so many people, and how much it shapes them going forward with their view of themselves and the way they look at others and relationships and all that.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was important. And we have a 1-800 number, 1-800-4-A-CHILD. And that's one of the reasons why I mentioned the book too, so I could talk about that. Because if you feel like there's abuse going on, you can call. The other thing is, like, we talk to, if you're a parent and you're stressed and you're thinking about getting angry at your kids, you can call that number too. So that was important.
We'll be back with more of John Stamos and Kelly Rizzo, my plus one, right after this.
This podcast is brought to you by NerdWallet. Are you paying for your me time with just any credit card in your wallet? While you shouldn't stop treating yourself, you should start paying with a credit card that has perks. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending. So what could future you do with better rewards? A free flight? Room upgrades? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We're back with Kelly Rizzo and John Stamos. Let's go back to music because I feel like you didn't really tell me about that. Because you write, without music, life would be a mistake. That's a Nietzsche quote. My dad thought it was stupid. I don't think he knew how important music was to me. Of course, he didn't think it was so stupid when I went on to play drums with the Beach Boys, John Fogerty and Bruce Springsteen, B.B. King, Willie Nelson, Little Richard, America. God, remember America? I loved America. Tom Jones and many more greats over the years. That's so cool.
I've been blessed to. I'm a decent drummer. I'm a terrible singer. And a melody was always sort of escape. I love hearing it, but I can't play. So I played drums. It was my identity, you know. Even before wanting to be an actor, I didn't really act in school, and I wasn't in any of the plays, and I wasn't a good singer. But finding something early, and I encourage any parent to steer their kid towards something that they help find their identity. And that's how I was in junior high school. In high school, I was a drummer. I was in the marching band, the jazz band. I just loved it. And the first time I heard the Beach Boys song at Disneyland, I was across the park at the Matterhorn, and I heard Sloop John B, and it pulled me over like a Pied Piper, you know. And I pulled up. I got to the stage and they were singing this a cappella part of Sloop John B. I was like, oh my God, what is it? What is that? You know, it was, I called the Beach Boys music harp music. You don't have to think about it. But, and so I just set off and being, the acting cut sort of took off first. I always wanted to play drums on TV. When I was on General Hospital, can I play drums? They're like, we're not taking requests, kid, you know, relax. And then one day I said to my dad, Dad, this guy named Sammy Jr. something's on the show. What? He's like, Sammy Davis Jr.? I'm like, yeah. Oh my God, he's a legend. And that started my love for the Rat Pack and my dad saying, you gotta listen to Sinatra, Dean Martin, or Sammy. So I said, what do I talk to him about? He said, well, he's a drummer. Talk to him about playing drums, maybe. So the scene was that Sammy was playing a character, and I was the host of the talent show at the waterfront. We were raising money for the street kids and stuff. And I was standing next to him. I said, Mr. Davis, they won't let me play drums on the drum. And he said, and I talked to him about music, and I had a real conversation about it. And I do impressions.
Yeah, day. Do it. Do Sammy Davis.
You started
Junior.
Off.
Yeah,
you might
I was like, keep going.
So I talked to him about music, and he said, okay, man, hold on, man. And he goes over to somewhere to talk to the producers, and he comes back and says, just do what I say, man. I go, what? And I remember him being very firm, just do what I say in the scene. I go, okay. So I introduce him as the character, and he comes out, and then he goes, Blackie, you play drums, right? I'm like, and it completely ad-libbed, and it's on YouTube. And I'm like, yeah, he goes, come up here.
Because the best way to start the show, since I'm an opening act, is with a little jazz.
Oh,
come on.
I'm touched. We're going to do a little thing here together?
That's it.
And he plays piano. There was a drum. There was a band set up. And he's playing piano, and I'm playing drums. And you're
one, two, three, four.
And you could see this the sage, like, passing on to the young man, like, you're one of us, you're a musician, you get it. And it was the most beautiful, and we just kept playing. They didn't stop us, they didn't dare stop us. And I heard later that everybody in New York and LA, and everyone was walking towards the monitors, like, you know, like, oh my God, what's happening there? And it ended, and he gave me this big hug, and it was just, you know, I'd been playing music on TV ever since, thanks to him.
What a great story, what a great story. And now you and Mike Love and the Beach Boys are like BFFs, right?
The Beach Boys, I was obsessed with the Beach Boys as a kid. I was obsessed with them, and it was the first concert I ever went to at the Universal Amphitheater, you know, before it had the roof on it. And I just never imagined that one day I'd be with them. One of the first times I played with them was in, they would do these concerts, you know, at the 4th of July, they did a few shows, and then James Watt said, they're attracting the wrong people. They're not America's band, blah, blah, blah. And they banned them and brought...
Oh, they did the Interior Secretary?
Yeah, that jackass. And they got Wayne Newton instead. And said, Don Cashane, you know. And Nancy Reagan said, no, I'm more of she was more of a surfer girl than a Don Cashane gal. And so they got rid of him and then brought the Beach Boys back. And that's when I did it with them. In the afternoon, it was... in Philadelphia for 1 million people, and where Bob's from, and then D.C. for 750,000 people. That was one of the first times I played with them.
Wow.
Are you worried about anything in this book, John? I mean, you talk about your marriage to Rebecca Romaine that was challenging and difficult, and I always thought, wow, two people in the same profession must be a very fraught situation, right? And it turned out to be for you all.
Yeah, I don't know if it was because, I mean, I don't know. It was interesting. That was a discovery that I made, and you know what? You're the first person to ask me about that, this. They were saying, well, you have to write about that. I said, no, I don't, but I guess I did. And what I came to discover, you know, all these years, I was like, she's a terrible person, and she did this, and she did that, blah, blah, blah. And in rehab, when I was doing the 12 steps, the fourth step is to write down all your resentments, and she did that. You know, I had a field day with that, and the guy says, are you done? And I said, no, give me another pen, and I'm writing all this stuff. And he said, now, what part did you play in that? I said, what? I didn't pay it. Well, even if it was 1%. And I started writing that down, and I realized I had... more to do with the demise of our marriage than I was willing to admit all these years. And at that moment, I just learned to forgive and let it go. But so that was the only way I really was going to write about what happened in the book, that she was, it just didn't work out. No good guys, no bad, it's just the way it is.
But, I think writing a book, you have to be honest about your flaws. And sometimes that's kind of embarrassing, but you have to say where you fell short and what you wish you had done differently. I mean, it's a very sometimes painful look at your life. Obviously, there are a lot of incredibly wonderful things that happen, but you have to reassess some of the things that you did and own it.
Yeah. Otherwise, what's the point? I did start out to write a hero story. I did this. And then I was like, no. And then it became a human story.
Well, you said you wanted it to be relatable, and that's... how you can be relatable is when you're human and you're showing, as you said, how you fell short. And, if you're the hero story, it's not going to be as relatable to people.
Right.
Before we go, Kelly, obviously, I think for you, from what I understand, reading about Bob and reading what John wrote about Bob and what he meant to him, I mean, that must have been an incredible experience for you, both one of pain, but also one of great memories. And when you called John after you read the part about Bob, what did you say?
Yeah, well, I wanted John to know, in case we didn't have as much time to discuss it today, just to hear from me how much it meant to me, not only as Bob's wife and as John's friend, but also just as somebody in the public who's going to read this, how they're going to see Bob and see how he was portrayed as a person, as a friend, because, you write about even parts of our relationship, or mine and Bob's, as a husband, as a friend, as a brother, which you had said that you guys had always both, you wanted brothers. And so you guys finally did become that to each other after, wasn't right away, took a few years. But I told you yesterday when I called you in tears, that it just meant so much to me that you told his story so beautifully and about just who he was and how people reading this are just going to get such an incredible picture of who he truly was as a person. But also the memory that you have of so many of these instances were so detailed, and it was also so great to get it from your perspective, because as I said, I had really only heard Bob's perspective, and you just did such a beautiful, wonderful tribute to him, and he would be so proud. I know his girls are going to be so proud. I'm so proud, and you should just be so proud.
Thank you. That means the world to me. I was really, you know, I didn't know what, I didn't know. I was really, but thank you. I appreciate that.
I was telling Kelly, I lost a good friend recently, and I am going to carry her in my heart and try to be more like her moving on. And I'm just curious if there's anything about you that changed after losing Bob.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, Kelly can attest that his whole thing was, he never left anything on the table. He always said, I love you, I care about you, you know. And tomorrow is never promised. And Bob lived his life that way, right? And he went out, I remember talking to him, Jamie Lee Curtis, she wrote the thing in the front. I remember telling Jamie, like, he was so alive. And she said, yeah, isn't that, wouldn't you rather die alive and vibrant than some old, you know, curmudgeon on the couch, to, you know, that didn't, you know, fulfill his dreams. And Kelly can attest too, he had a new thing about him. He felt like a teenager again. He was doing new stuff. And he played that last night, that last show he played was like a 2-hour show, right? I mean, he just, and, you know, I just wrote about just picturing him going, you know, on his way home, he called Kelly and said he had a great show, and he had a picture, and he wanted her to fix it up. And she said, you look handsome, but I don't need to fix anything there. And it was beautiful. And he just loved you so much, Kelly. And I just pictured him going to bed, thinking about all of us, all the people that he loves, that he would see us again. And the laughter didn't have time to die down, and he left us. But what I hope he felt when he fell asleep and didn't wake up.
Well, if I could just share one thing. Sorry. I love you, John. Anyway, that really got me, that made me like start bawling. This is why I called you yesterday, because there was one quote from it that, you know, for people listening to this, that it was such an incredible, like, personal little exchange that just shows how well you knew Bob too. And it's just kind of explained this, like, all three of our, like, relationship. But you said, I knew from the start that she really loved Bob for Bob, the way we all did. She'd listen to him rattle on about himself for a bit longer than I usually would. The first time she said to him, this isn't all about you, Bob, I knew she was the one. He'd pout, she'd kiss him, and in a sweet tone, she'd say, you know I love you, honey. As we hug in the driveway, I tell her, you got ripped off. You didn't have him long enough. Yeah. And, you know, and I've said before that that's one of those things that it's so understandable why people think that, because, you know, we'd only had 3.5 years of being married, but, and I'm sure you feel this now too, that it's just, there's so much of an overwhelming feeling of gratitude that we did have him at all. Versus feeling we didn't have him longer. So
that's true. We're all better off because of him. And, you know, we have to really take his thing and just live each moment for the most we can and be loving.
And as you said, leave nothing unsaid. Maybe that's right. A good lesson from Bob. You know, tell people in your life regularly what they mean to you.
Amen.
And you both mean so much to me.
Oh, thanks, John. By the way, when I Instagram stalk you, you are beloved. I mean, everyone loves you, John Stamos.
What is that supposed to mean?
You're very popular. Like when it was your birthday, all the notes and the comments, I was like, good Lord, this guy is very well loved. And I meant it as a compliment, not as a diss.
And well deserved.
No, I appreciate it. Okay, thank you. I mean, but I think that's another reason to write a book. And I'm sure you felt this too. It's like, the book is not like an Instagram post and a blip here and a blip there and here, look what I'm doing here. You know, it's a deep dive, right? But thank you, Katie. I'm going to start listening to your book tonight.
Really? Okay.
Did you enjoy the audio part? That was my favorite part. It was the hardest, but I really loved doing the audio.
It was hard, honestly. And it was during the pandemic. So this makeshift studio I put together in a bedroom, I had like blankets. It was like a fort we'd build as a kid with pillows and blankets and under, you know, this huge mess of stuff because we didn't have a recording studio to do it in. And it was exhausting. I have to say it was exhausting, but it was worth it because I think to have you narrating your own book, telling your own story, I can't imagine getting someone else to read your words. And by the way, you're a very good writer, John.
Well, thank you. It was the hardest. They said, oh, you can get it done in 5 or 6 days. I took like 32 days or something. Because it would just start. First of all, you're cold reading your life, and that's weird. And you could change things, and that didn't sound right. And it was very emotional. I would just go, you know, after a couple hours, I'd be like, I gotta go. That's too much.
Yeah, you gotta pace yourself.
But I'm glad I did it, and I'm glad to talk to you guys today about this.
Yeah, and I'm excited to hear your audio as well. Well, thank you for doing this, John. Kelly, thank you for doing it. This
thank
was
you
so
for
fun,
having me.
And
what
I
an
think.
Honor.
Kelly added such an important dimension, and it was really nice for me to witness your friendship and how much you love each other and mean to each other, and the fact that you tell each other that and leave nothing unsaid.
I do. I appreciate you, Kelly.
I love you, brother.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you have a question for me, a subject you want us to cover, or you want to share your thoughts about how you navigate this crazy world, reach out. You can leave a short message at 609-512-5505, or you can send me a DM on Instagram. I would love to hear from you. Next Question is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are me, Katie Couric, and Courtney Litz. Our supervising producer is Ryan Martz, and our producers are Adriana Fazio and Meredith Barnes. For more information about today's episode or to sign up for my newsletter, Wake Up Call, go to the description in the podcast app or visit us at katiecouric.com. You can also find me on Instagram and all my social media channels. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.